You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following special episode of ArsenalForDemocracy.com was recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, on Sunday, December 7th, 2014. I'll talk to three guests from St. Louis County, Missouri, and Chicago, Illinois, about the decision in Ferguson, Missouri, as well as the spreading Black Lives Matter protests. All this is coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. We're going to be talking now about the situation in Ferguson, the situation in New York, and the wider picture with the various protests that have been going on. Joining me on the line, we have three different folks, all returning guests to Arsenal for Democracy. From Chicago, we have Jamie on the line. Jamie Nesbitt-Golden, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Jamie is, of course, a writer and social media activist. And from St. Louis County, we have Amma. Amma, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And also from St. Louis County, JP is joining us.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Okay, so I want to start narrowly with the decision in Ferguson and then move out from there. Amma, you live probably closest to the epicenter of what's going on, basically next to Ferguson. This reaction, obviously, on an objective basis, seemed to be bigger in the most recent case than in the initial sort of triggering incident in August. Amma, why don't you walk us through what you've been seeing there in your area and in Ferguson itself?
Yeah, so I live in Delwood, which is kind of partially subsumed by Ferguson. You know, it's encircled by Ferguson. In fact, to get from one part of Ferguson to another, you might through the main arteries, you will drive through Delwood. So what we've seen over the past couple of weeks since the announcement of the non-indictment of Darryl Wilson have been, you know, protests and, you know, and really that outrage, that lashing out that we all saw on TV, because I was not out on the streets that night. In fact, I'm glad I was not, because the way I was feeling, right, that level of outrage that I felt, that my wife felt. In fact, I was watching with my kids. We had taken the approach of not kind of sharing the details, but everybody's talking about it. You know, they're talking about it in school. They're talking about it everywhere. But so as a family, we kind of watched the non-indictment happen and watched things start to spiral out of control. And so the immediate aftermath, to me, the sense that things were going, like the outrage was being vented, was when we got that feeling when we saw folks kind of smashing up the cop car and then the cops coming in and trying to kind of securing the vehicle, but they had shotguns. And they were pointing him, I mean, this is on live TV, they're pointing him at the crowd, and I'm thinking, okay, so the cops are going to shoot somebody right here on live TV, so I need to send my kids away. Because that was a level of tension that we were feeling, that we saw that day. And, you know, and the fact that this was happening on North Florissant Avenue, not West Florissant, which is kind of the business district of Ferguson, where protests have happened, I mean, consecutively, while there was tear gas and such going on in West Florissant in August, in North Florissant, there were protesters outside the police station that never got that rude hand of the law. So the fact that was happening there really got my attention. And you know, I had the sinking feeling that, you know, things were going to go pretty far that night, because there were protests everywhere. There were protests in the city. You know, that's the big difference, I think, between August and now, is that the protests, I mean, there have been such an outpouring of support from all different corners and even places that we weren't expecting. We had a major private school upper class in West County. The upper school students staged a walkout, which, you know, these kids have nothing in common with the kids in my neighborhood, right? And they felt like something bad had happened and they needed to do something. So I think that's the difference, that there's been just some much broader support on the one hand, but also because of the damage was sustained by businesses in the area, there's also been that knee-jerk reaction, you know, in different quarters about, well, why are they tearing up their own neighborhoods? That's, how is that going to change the indictment? How is that justice? You know, blah, blah, blah. But overall, you know, the outrage, while I know that the feelings are still raw, then there was a hope of some sort that there will be a recourse via the system, you know, somewhere to channel that sense of injustice. And when we were denied that, it's just really no surprise. I'm really surprised that it was so contained. And if the fire departments had done an even halfway competent job of fighting the fires, there would be even fewer businesses damaged and destroyed. But I did drive around the next day, and I was really touched by the amount of damage. I mean, I understand that there are folks' businesses and jobs and whatnot, and you know, destruction is hard to see. But I was also really a little taken aback at how close it was to my house. I mean, I'm not far away at all from West Florissant and Chambers, and the car dealership that got a bunch of cars set on fire was pretty doggone close. But I will say pretty vehemently, though, that there were absolutely zero residential areas targeted by the protesters in with this kind of heavy destruction, and by, you know, actually by whomever was doing the fire setting. And so to that extent, a lot of, you know, we were fine. Our homes are fine. I mean, it was just shocking to see all the military on the street. I mean, I started taking pictures of Humvees and videos. I mean, it was just really surreal. You know, you try to go to the gas station, try to go to the drugstore. Almost every corner on West Florissant, I mean, every turnoff from that street had a Humvee in it and two guys assigned. You know, it was just really surreal to see that.
I want to bring JP in at this point. As we had talked about when he was on the show in August, JP comes from a military background, and specifically, I think you had said military police, if I'm remembering correctly.
I was signal and admin, but worked with military police.
What was your reaction to seeing the National Guard being deployed essentially to replace the police for police functions, but then having the police doing the military functions on sort of riot control? What was going through your head when you saw this happening?
I would actually have to say I'm really relieved at the posture and part of the work that the National Guard has done, because I had really suspected that it would end up looking like something from New Orleans during Katrina, where you had troops actually pointing their weapons at people who are in New Orleans, hot and thirsty and hungry with no kind of shelter. But here in St. Louis, we've been protesters just voicing their dismay with the whole system. But I am very disheartened at the placement of it, because if I'm not mistaken, there was an upwards of over 2,000 troops brought in. But the placement, you could have had a squad here going down the entire length of West Florissant and also into other areas to ensure that people's property wasn't damaged or anything. But from basically what I saw, because we basically knew the indictment was coming, I went ahead and took West Florissant as a detour on my way home, but I didn't see anyone out there. And like going back to Amma said, I'm trying not to say lackadaisical attitude or response, but the response of the fire departments and surrounding fire departments, he just wasn't there. So it just basically left me and quite a few other people just wondering. And it's like, did you really want it to burn? Because an indictment that night, instead of releasing it during the day so people can go ahead and vent whatever, while you still have good sight to see what's going on, instead of waiting till the end of night. But that's basically my thoughts on that particular aspect of the whole situation.
Right. That was an accusation that I had heard the night that this was happening. You know, I saw this on social media and a couple other places from folks who were there saying, why is it that, you know, the police can get there right away, but it takes 30 minutes for the fire department to show up, you know, to contain these things? There were some businesses that hadn't been targeted that then caught on fire because they were next to something that was targeted. Do we have any indication that there was sort of any intentionality or, as JP put it, lackadaisical attitudes here on kind of controlling the situation, that they were sort of having the appearance of controlling the situation but weren't actually putting in the effort to do that? I guess it's a little hard to sort of second guess them on that, but...
Well, I do have a slightly anecdotal, you know, case to make on there being a less than professional response to the fires. And as much as I, you know, I've had a security system on my house for the last maybe 3-4 years, I've got one of those deals where, you know, the fire detector will call the fire department. Well, I took a super hot shower yesterday, the steam triggered the fire alarm, and, you know, and so they called and I punched in the cancel code. But before I could get all that resolved, so say 3 minutes between me punching in the canceling code, you know, and receiving the call from the, you know, the monitoring company, the county police showed up at my door and a fire truck was on my street within, I want to say it was less than 4 minutes. I mean, the response was superb, you know, from the initial signal being sent. And even though I punched in the cancel code, they still showed up and they made sure that I was all good. So the capacity to respond exists in this area. I mean, what, there's at least 3 fire stations within a mile of each of those fires. Yeah, so I feel like the response was less than professional.
JP, what were you hearing from other folks that you know in the area? I think you had mentioned to me before we started recording that some of your coworkers live in Ferguson. What were the sort of the other reactions that you've been hearing from other folks about the events that played out?
It has been a bit mixed. I would say most people basically expected it. They knew McCullough wasn't going to deliver an indictment. And I think it was Osmond Lovey who had a blog post about people's reactions, was some people just accept it. Well, we know who we have to deal with, and it is basically accepted. Not that we're just rolling over with it, but it was just a no-no. So on that part, as far as the indictment, we know about it. It wasn't anything surprising. But it wasn't really too much surprising at the aftermath, because we basically knew you had some outside people coming in. You had the people who were already there coming in. And then, just from lessons I learned from taking a look at things last time and my time in the military, if you go into a certain community and you keep messing with them and agitating them, then the lowest elements or the criminal element of that population, they will clap back. And when they clap back, it's going to be that much harder because, one, they already don't like you. Two, you just gave them that much reason more. So when things exploded, it was a bit expected, but still left quite a few people a bit shocked.
All right. Well, I want to zoom out now and take a look at the wider picture here. Obviously, that night, protests started spreading to other major cities in the United States, you know, Chicago, New York, and Boston. And then they continued into the next night. And then we also, of course, saw with the Eric Garner case that protests started up again the following week in many of those same cities. So I want to turn now to Jamie. You were at the protests related to the decision in Ferguson in Chicago. Could you talk a little bit about what you were seeing in that protest?
Sure. Well, you know, we had gathered outside of police headquarters here, and there were about, the crowd was about maybe about 200 people present, maybe a little more. And someone held, you know, their smartphone to a loudspeaker. So we were all listening to Bob McCullough announce the decision. And as soon as he said that, you know, Wilson wouldn't be indicted or wouldn't be recommended, you know, wouldn't be recommended for an indictment, a groan fell over the crowd, people sort of cursing and, you know, and angry, and rightfully so. And, you know, some people crying. And soon afterwards, there was a march. And that night, protesters shut down Lakeshore Drive and made their way down to downtown Chicago. And, you know, there was, you know, you couldn't help but feel defeated And, you know, you knew what was going to happen. It was, you know, you kind of predicted it, but you wanted to be wrong. And in a few days, you know, I think prior to that or a little after was the Tamir Rice killing in Cleveland. And, you know, it's sort of been this sort of organized resistance since. People, you know, sort of going out and protesting and, you know, like shutting stuff down. And it hasn't let up. And I don't think it will. People are angry, again, justifiably so. And it's really, you know, time for a structural change in how we deal with police violence.
Now, there were certainly, I think, a number of skeptics the night that this non-indictment happened, you know, and I can see where they're coming from, even if it's not really helpful for them to say, of saying, you know, that, oh, this is just a sort of another flash in the pan. It's not going to go anywhere. You know, we've seen this before, that kind of thing. And I think that I would guess, and this is pure speculation, that part of the reason that they dragged out the decision in Ferguson so long was that they were hoping that if they waited until the week of Thanksgiving, that nobody would be able to sort of sustain that anger. But of course, there are new incidents, like you said, with Tamir Rice happening every single week or almost every day. And then it seems like now there are, you know, non-indictments happening basically every other day at this point. And that's not new either. But it seems like we've sort of hit some sort of a tipping point, especially with the Eric Garner case, because it was on video, so it was very clear to see what was going on. Do you think that this is going to build into sort of a larger thing, you know, that this is finally the moment when this problem that's existed for quite a while now is going to get the attention that it deserves?
I honestly think it is. I think we've been seeing it. You know, people expected initially after the Mike Brown case, you know, folks were going to protest just, you know, maybe for a few days and then all die down and, you know, we'll, you know, go to something else. And that hasn't been the case. Like, you know, I know folks who've been out there protesting since the day after Mike Brown. And it's, you know, it's gaining momentum and it continues to gain momentum. And I think, unfortunately, it took, you know, the Eric Garner case to make folks understand that these are not anomalies. Like, this is happening. You know, I think someone crunched numbers every 28 hours. So you are, you know, so some black person or a person of color is going to be the victim of police violence, you know, in the next day or so. Like, this is an ongoing thing. And I don't see people, I don't see activists letting up soon. I think, you know, after the Mike Brown case, we wanted to focus on, you know, body cams for cops and, well, that's all well and good, but here's something else that happened on camera and we still didn't get any justice. So we're going to have to, you know, think about, you know, not only preventative measures for police officers, but punitive measures. Like, what happens when a cop, you know, is caught on film, you know, behaving badly? And, you know, and what about police departments who don't hold these rogue cops responsible? Like, what happens and what are the next steps to prevent, you know, another non-indictment? I think these are, you know, things to really consider.
Yeah, there's been a number of articles in places like The Atlantic and some sort of more left-wing publications of, you know, like far-left publications talking about the issue of police unions and that they especially have been, I mean, certainly we saw this with the Ferguson case. I mean, they even had the police union fighting with the St. Louis Rams, which was stupid. But you know, these unions are basically backing up. I mean, it's part of their job to back up the officers, but to the point of, like, even when there are consequences and people lose their jobs for things that are very clear cut, like stalking exes and, you know, attacking people that they know and things like that, they'll get reinstated with back pay eventually because of the, you know, the union advocacy and the arbitration. Is there anything that we can do to fix that? Is there anything on the horizon regarding that? Or is that just, you know, another thing that can't really be fixed because that's not even the traditional legal system?
Well, I think there needs to be, and maybe someone will bring this up, or maybe they have already, you know, maybe a special committee, a special independent committee that will sort of monitor these, you know, police departments and also the, you know, policemen associations, because those are problematic as well. So you need eyes everywhere. And to that end, I think, you know, we form an independent committee, you know, we vet the people on said committee because you never know who's connected to who. And then, you know, if something like this happens again. Well, I shouldn't say if, because it, you know, it just happened in Phoenix, like a couple days ago with Remain Brisbane. When this sort of thing happens, we have to have people who aren't connected to anything to investigate these things and then make, you know, make the police department do their job. And even if that means, you know, firing or disciplining or arresting one of their own.
Now, these different cases have had their own sort of specific slogans, like in Ferguson, the hands up, don't shoot, and in the Eric Garner, the I can't breathe. But there's been this overarching one, which is Black Lives Matter. And I was wondering, Jamie, if you could kind of explain sort of where that comes from and, you know, some ways that it's inclusive and some ways that it's more specific and appropriate than some of the other sort of, we'll say, competing slogans that have emerged from this.
Yeah. So Black Lives Matter was actually a sort of activist organization formed by Patrice Cullors, who I believe is out of California. And she's an academic as well. And around the time, I guess about a couple months ago, there was Ferguson October, which was something that Black Lives Matter sort of, you know, organized, which, you know, was this really great action. It was a multi-day sort of thing with protests and workshops and teach-ins. And I have no issue with the idea of Black Lives Matter, because I think that's, you know, who's the most at risk. Like, you know, we don't see white folks, you know, getting gunned down with, you know, such alarming frequency. If anything, it's Black men, it's Black women. And again, I want to make it a point to, you know, not neglect the women who have also been felled by police violence. I think that's really important to keep in mind. So for me, I think Black Lives Matter is a great organization. They've taken a mantle and they are, you know, organizing folks nationwide. And it's been, you know, really amazing to see. And while I do understand that folks might take issue with the title or with, you know, the tag, you know, again, these are our lives on the line. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that not all lives are valuable, but we have to focus on the ones who aren't seen as valuable. So that's, you know, that's pretty much it.
I wanted to read some little quotes from an article that was passed along by a friend of the show. And this is from June of 2014 in the Daily Camera Boulder News. I think this article has been being passed around a lot this week for its sort of ironic contrast. And I'll just read a couple bits and then sort of open it up for reactions here to all three of you. So this was about a police officer in Boulder, Colorado, who was convicted by a jury for unjustified use of force, found guilty on all 9 counts. And his use of unjustifiable lethal force was that he, in a residential area, used his firearm while on duty to kill a particularly majestic elk, which was a, you know, the animal with the antlers and everything, for those not familiar with this.
Wow.
And then there was, he tried to cover it up. So there were various felony counts for, you know, forgeries and, you know, evidence tampering and all that stuff. And I think his partner like ratted him out and everything and took a plea deal and all that. But anyway, there were various quotes here. This was about something that is essential to every community, and that is integrity in public service. Let's see, the residents, it said, this article said, this death sparked outrage and immediate calls for action against the two police officers who were involved in this. There was debate during deliberation, but that ultimately the prosecution proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. He talks about, you know, irrefutable evidence, all that kind of thing, and then says, you know, how hard this was to be on the jury, said no one took any pleasure in convicting Mr. Carter. It wasn't something anyone took joy or pride in, but we do believe the verdict we came to was honest and served justice in this case. And then said, I don't think any of us will be walking away from this anytime soon. I think we will carry this for a while. Again, these are the jurors on the case for this horribly murdered elk. And then there was somebody commenting that it's so rare for an animal to get any semblance of justice in our court system. So that's a case that actually went to trial and everything. That's a real story.
That's a real story. Wow.
And, I don't even have a reaction to this at this point. It's so absurd, this contrast here. I don't know if any of you have any other particular reactions to it.
I'm sorry, I can't help but laugh.
Oh yeah, I was lucky enough to come across this a couple days ago, and I was just so disgusted because I was in my commonly ignored Facebook newsfeed, and you know, you can see the outrage, and then you know, outrage cat pics, outrage dog. Outrage, outrage, outrage. And then I saw the elk thing and I read it and I'm like, are you kidding me? And, you know, so my college roommate is pouring his heart out about how he feels helpless and hopes about the future for his kids and fearful, right, in this environment we're living in, you know, and we have friends who have become police officers. We have colleagues from college, you know, that have become members of law enforcement, and it's just like, it does not matter, right? We all feel like our kids don't have the freedom to exist like normal humans in American society. And you know, so juxtaposed with that is the story of the gosh darn elk, right? And everybody's upset because, you know, he posed with a picture, you know what I mean? Like, I just thought it was really a great contrast. It showed, I mean, it's the same thing arguably with the same argument that has been made with, you know, whatever, Mike Vick versus, say, Roethlisberger, or, you know, whatever the case. You know, so there's well, we have this outrage, unforgivable act, you know, done by a police officer to a beloved animal. And then a human being gets shot by the police in even worse circumstances, and we get arguments. We get all lives matter. We get not all cops. We get I am Darryl Wilson. You know what I'm saying? And that stings to the core. It stings to the core of us because it's challenging our humanity. It's saying in no uncertain terms that you are not valued as a human. You are not valued as a person. And damn it, my elk is more important than your life.
It's interesting that you bring this up because a few days before, I think, Mike Brown, there was a St. Louis County cop charged with assaulting a man with a baton on a Metrolink platform earlier this summer. And of course, the cop is black. And basically, he was charged. He was arrested and charged for tapping a man on the hand with his baton while he was working security for Metrolink. So we get this, right? We get the cop basically, you know, charged and arrested for what would be considered, you know, something minor. And then Mike Brown happens. And, you know, we can arrest a guy for, you know, swatting, you know, a commuter, a badly behaving commuter with a baton. But when it comes to, like, out-and-out murder, it's very interesting, though.
I just checked the front page, actually, of that newspaper in Boulder. And apparently it's now a front page story that their old story from June went viral because of this. I mean, they're very aware of, like, how crazy this looks. You know, this, and it's so disgusting, as you all say. But
I mean, it feels something, like, for a minute, I thought, you know, it was a South Park plot. Like, it really sounds like something that would happen in an episode of South Park. Like, there's no way, but it happens. It happens.
All right. Alma sent me an article here going back to sort of the St. Louis County area from St. Louis Public Radio. The headline here, St. Louis County Emergency Fund Tapped for Police. They had a special emergency meeting of the county council and appropriated $2.5 million to pay for overtime of officers and, you know, supplies, food, and clothing. Alma, JP, either one of you want to react to this particular angle on this story here?
I'll let Alma go first if you want.
I just thought it was a little ironic. That's why I shared it. It's a little ironic that, you know, as county residents, we're going to pay, we pay massive taxes. I shouldn't say massive taxes. We pay taxes here for all these county services, for our parks and whatnot. And you know, to get charged for your own tear gassing, man, that's got to sting more than it stings more than a little bit when you think about the level of service that was delivered, right? That we're paying for. This is to pay for, I think it's $3.5 million, and $2.5 million is to pay for overtime for the police officers, right? So that's where the majority of the money is going, directly to the guys who are out there pointing sniper rifles at the people out there exercising their constitutional rights, right? So that is what we're dealing with. So it doesn't matter, right? This, and it was voted, you know, it was unopposed. It was going to happen anyway. You know what I'm saying? Like, our hands are still tied. And that's why I'm grateful for the momentum that's been maintained, because we have to push forward. I mean, Bob McCullough ran unopposed in November, right? On the ballot, I had to write in somebody else's name in protest, right? That's how bad, you know, that's how cyclical things are. And, you know, so we have to sustain the momentum through enough cycles to kind of clean house. Yeah, I thought the article was crazy.
Speaking of elections, JP had reminded me the other day on Twitter that Jeff Rorta, I think his name is, the spokesman of the St. Louis County Police Union, who's sort of a disgraced ex-police officer himself, had been on the ballot this past November running for state Senate, and that Governor Jay Nixon was, you know, doing campaign events for him and everything, and specifically saying that Rorta was so important, you know, for, and that office in particular was so important for maintaining law and order and the rule of law down there in St. Louis County, which, I mean, I don't know how loud you can make a dog whistle before it's not a dog whistle anymore, but that seemed pretty on the nose. And Rorta lost, but, you know, he lost to some Republican by, you know, less than 4,000 votes, and I'm sure that Republican's not any better on this either. JP, did you have any comments on any of these stories?
Yeah, basically, to pull the line like I posted on Twitter from the infamous show The Wire, follow the money, and you'll never know what you're going to find. But it basically goes to part of Missouri politics and the feeling that's felt towards some of the elected officials. It is hardly unlikely Jay Nixon would have gotten into office if it wasn't for the majority of the black vote that's here in St. Louis, Jeff City, and Kansas City, because you can look at any electoral map and see Missouri is quite the red state. So in Jay Nixon's movements to not really prodding McCullough more for stepping down and assigning a special prosecutor, that didn't surprise me, nor did it really surprise anyone else. And to know that he stumped for Rorta, but yet Rorta and McCullough basically work hand in hand and even raise money for Darren Wilson. So he just adds a level of insult to the whole indictment and the whole due process, because when McCullough wants to get something, he'll get it. Like, I want to say it was someone from, like, Guns N' Roses. I'm not sure if it was maybe Slash or Axl Rose or some other big rocker. He got an indictment and hounded the man until he basically turned himself in and paid a fine. So when he wants to get something, he can get it. But in the case where he doesn't, he won't. So anyone that knows Missouri politics, because I'm quite sure Jay Nixon knew about the I think it was back in the 90s or early 2000s, you had two black men who were suspects basically in a parking lot of some fast food joint. They probably went to drive through, who knows? But basically, you had two undercover officers basically tailing them. So instead of calling for backup because they didn't want them to leave, they went ahead and approached the car and then proceeded to shoot it up. Turns out that both men were unarmed. But McCullough did not seek an indictment, basically called these guys the scum of the earth and basically that they deserve to die. So it is not really surprising to see how Missouri politics plays out based on just even just on the recent past.
All right. Jamie, on the front lines of these sort of spreading national protests, I know you mentioned that a lot of this has been sort of, you know, there's been a lot of leading roles for black women within this movement, and that, you know, this is bigger than just black men, although, you know, I was a little discouraged by some of the protests being organized that I saw, which shall remain nameless for the moment, that were specifically focused on black men and were, you know, mm-hmm. not involving female black victims, trans black victims, mm-hmm. you know, or were going in the opposite direction and trying to make this about everyone. What's the outlook here, you know, both within the black community and also in terms of sort of intersectional matters and sort of solidarity? What can we expect and what should folks who want to sort of help be doing to help in the right way?
Well, that's a good question. I feel like social media has been a great help in connecting folks who want to get involved. So to that end, I think Black Lives Matter is on Twitter, also on Facebook. There are communities popping up every day on Facebook, with various groups sort of organizing actions. And, you can find your way, you can find them on there. But I think the bigger picture is that, like, we realize that it's not just Black men. And I think for every attempt to sort of diminish the role of Black women in this movement, they have been adamant about being heard and being seen. So you see folks like Netta, you see folks like Ashley, and I cannot remember her last name, which is horrible, but you see these women, these remarkable young women sort of, you know, leading the charge. So I think it's important to acknowledge that. And also the fact that, you know, it's not just Black men who are, you know, being shot down by police or being murdered by police. And so, you know, again, for every attempt to downplay our roles and erase us from the front lines, I'm seeing, you know, a bigger, more sizable resistance, so that, you know, trans men and trans women are also included, because it's not just, you know, heterosexual, it's not just, you know, straight folks getting killed out there as well. But again, I don't see this losing steam anytime soon. And I think we have to, you know, in order for, you know, people to really help or want it, the people who want to be allies, I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, that we shouldn't try to derail from the subject at hand, that it's great to say that all lives matter. It's great to say it's not just cops, you know, not just men, or not just women. But to keep in mind that sometimes, particularly within this movement, you have to know when to lead and when to take a back seat and follow. So just these are, again, things just to sort of keep in mind. But for the most part, I'm very inspired by what I see. And for everybody who says that, you know, like younger generation doesn't do anything, or that they're, you know, sitting on their hands, or they're too obsessed with this, that, and the other, I'm seeing, you know, again, folks under 30 sort of taking the lead. And it's pretty amazing to see.
One thing that I had been thinking about a lot in the past few days, and I have a feeling you'll have some insights into this as well, for the past 14, maybe even 15 years between, let's say, the WTO clashes in the late 90s, and then, you know, when you had the anti-war stuff and the Occupy stuff, a lot of those seemed to lose steam relatively quickly. But as some people have pointed out, a lot of those movements were also very dominated by white American protesters.
Yes.
Do you think that there's something here that's going to be a lot more sustainable, that's going to overcome that sort of, for lack of a better word, meme that had emerged in the past 14 years, that the age of marching and the age of protests is over, and that, you know, it's going to have to, you know, move to a new sphere, or that there's, you know, there's no hope, there's no protests are going to happen. Like, what's going to be different about this? And I guess you could also include some of the other equally or even possibly more successful so far, sort of like immigrants' rights marches and things like that have happened in just the past couple of years.
I mean, I think that's pretty much it. I think the idea that the fact that this is a sort of a multicultural, multi-generational movement, you're seeing, you know, people who literally marched with King decades ago next to kids who weren't even here 15 years ago. That says a lot. With Occupy and with other protests, there was definitely a very centered whiteness to it. And folks, you know, people of color who did try to participate in those actions felt they didn't feel like a part of it. They felt very separated from the other groups. And it's very cliquish, and it's very, you know, there were so many things wrong with Occupy Wall Street. We wouldn't have time to list them here. You know, not saying that economics and economic equality isn't important, but in this instance, we're talking about life or death. It's a very dire thing. And there's more of an urgency to this. You know, if, again, we keep looking at the statistic, every 28 hours, another Black life is taken, you know, you're going to you're going to keep at it. You have no choice but to keep at it because, you know, we can't lose another person in this. So I definitely feel like what separates this from any other movement is that there are literally lives on the line. And if we you know, lose momentum, if we tap out now, there's no telling what's going to happen. And I think that's scary. So we, you know, people have no choice but to keep going.
All right. Well, that's going to bring us to the end of our discussion today, unfortunately. But there's certainly a lot more stuff happening online, as we've obviously been talking about. And so people can keep in touch on this issue and get connected on this. Probably one of the easiest ways to get plugged in really quickly on this is, you know, to keep up with our guest, Jamie Nesbitt Golden. She will at the very least be pointing you in the right direction of, you know, which people to follow and that sort of thing on Twitter. So you can follow her at The Way of the Id on Twitter. And your website, Hood Feminism, what is the URL for that?
Hoodfeminism.com.
All right. So Jamie is, of course, a writer and, you know, social media activist, and now, I guess, a bit of a street organizer as well. And thank you so much, Jamie, for being on here today.
Thank you for having me.
And from St. Louis County, Ama and JP, thank you both for being on here as well to talk about this.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Bill.
Thanks a lot.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.